Neil Scolding is Emeritus Burden Professor of Clinical Neuroscience at Bristol, and this is a nice twist, he's a visiting professor at Gulu University in Uganda, as well as being a consultant neurologist at Gloucester NHS Hospitals. He is actually the founding chair, or Burden chair, or Burden professorship in Bristol. And I remember being involved in interviewing you at one stage for that a long time ago. And apparently Gordon Stewart was very much part of the process of getting you in here. So it's great to have a local expert with us. But it not only is he a very eminent scientist and clinician, but he also has an interest in ethics. He's former chair of the Anscombe Centre for Catholic Bioethics and currently a guarantor of BRAIN and a member of the Pontifical Academy of Life, for Life, sorry. But he spends 4 months a year in Uganda in clinical research, teaching clinical practice and postgraduate training. So a man of many talents.
Thank you, Andrew, for that very kind invitation. And thank you to all of you. Thanks to all of you as well for turning out on a slightly chilly night. So this is concentrating from that sort of smorgasbord title, more on the topping and tailing. And there will be a little bit of ethics, a little bit of politics, a little bit of science, all to do essentially with what I've been doing over the last 25 years in Bristol. And I do like to start with this picture, which you may recognize as French A Hospital, which is where I was for the bulk of my time as Professor of Neurology, Professor of Clinical Neurosciences there. So, as Andrew mentioned, I three-quarters retired from that 4 or 5 years ago now in order to spend more time in Uganda, where my wife and I now spend 4 or 5 months a year at a medical school and hospital in the north of the country. And part of the reason for mentioning that is that John very kindly invited me to the February the 12th event, but we will in fact be in Uganda at that time, so I'm very sorry not to be at that that discussion. And then of course latterly we moved to Southmead, and the research, some of the research that I'll talk about is very much continuing there. So my principal interest has been multiple sclerosis, and that's been the area where I've specialized in clinical practice and also where I've concentrated in our research efforts, previously in Cambridge and then in Bristol for the last couple of decades. And multiple sclerosis is called multiple sclerosis, and it's illustrated quite well by this very old picture, getting on for 200 years, which is roughly how long the disease has been recognized. And that's the spinal cord, of course. And those brown patches are patches of multiple sclerosis. It's called multiple sclerosis. Sclerosis is scar, and there are multiple scars, which you can see very clearly in that autopsy spinal cord and in the brain at the top as well. And of course, that damage, these are areas of damage, and that damage causes significant neurological disability in many, not all, but in many individuals with multiple sclerosis. And we can now physically, very straightforwardly, see those patches in living patients with an MRI scan, and you see the MRI scan on the left, and that white patch, three-quarters of the way up the spinal cord, is a patch of damage from multiple sclerosis. And that accumulative damage over a period of years, as I said, in some, but very definitely not all, and that's one of the curious things about MS, is how varied it can be between different individuals, even when they start off having what looks like an identical disease, can lead to very significant and substantial disability. And working with this disease in the laboratory and working with patients over the years has led to two areas of ethical conflict, I would say, with the progressive world. And that essentially is where the topping and tailing in the title come from, because the two ethical areas relate very much to the beginning of life and to the end of life, and to the progressive world's desire to top and tail, to curtail early life and later life. And I'll talk about both of those. They are both areas where I have more or less been slightly reluctantly dragged into the public debate. So the end of life, the issue, of course, is assisted dying and euthanasia. And although I've become engaged in that debate, perhaps the first point to make is that in 30 years, I've only ever had one patient with multiple sclerosis, or indeed any other disease, who has brought up the subject and wanted to talk about it, and that, in fact, was rather a young lady with no disability at all and with significant psychological problems. No individuals with major disability have ever brought this subject up in outpatient clinics. Nonetheless, you may well be aware that neurological diseases are very much at the forefront of individuals and patients who do request assisted dying, and very much in the press as well. And assisted dying, of course, has come to the fore very much again lately. It sort of cycles in and out of the public eye, but some very high-profile celebrities, that's Esther Ranson, whose face is sadly covered. Some very high-profile celebrities have spoken in favour of it. And what I think is new, to my knowledge anyway, in the last few months is the popular press, the tabloid press, taking up the cause. The broadsheets that wish to call themselves the serious press, this is over 10 years old now, have long taken up the cause in favour of assisted dying. And this was one, what I think, a particularly egregious front page report. And you can't see some of the text. Tony Nicholson, who I say I might add did not have a terminal illness. He had persistent disability from a stroke, but not a terminal illness. Tony Nicholson defied the judges, the doctors, and the pro-life opponents who prolonged his suffering and died despite them all. Not, you might think, unbiased reporting. So this is the progressive view, and maybe shared by individuals here. The churches at their leadership level, the principal religious groups of the UK, the Judeo-Christian groups and the Muslims as well, have been as one in speaking officially against it, though, as you know, there are high-profile individuals in various of these religious groupings who have spoken in favour of assisted dying. So what are the arguments, and why have I been myself so vehemently opposed? I think there are three principles that are generally invoked as reasons to change the law and allow assisted dying. Each of these principles, I think, is deeply flawed. And then there are almost entirely unrelated to the principles, though in fact you will see they flow from the principles, practical reasons why I think even if you agreed with the principles and disagreed with the arguments I will make against them, why we should be very cautious indeed, and I would say should not take this route. So let's just look very briefly at those three principles and three practical aspects. So autonomy is the first and probably the commonest reason, theoretical reason invoked to support allowing assisted dying. And what is meant by that is essentially a right to die, as you saw from the press headlines. Now, of course, a right to die logically is a non-starter. All of us will die whether we think we have that right or not. So what is actually meant by that is a right to control when and where we die. In other words, effectively a right to suicide. Now, Dignity in Dying, previously the Voluntary Euthanasia Society, have always been very clear and adamant that they do not support a general right to suicide. But what this is, I would say, and I think logically it would be hard to contradict, that this is a restricted right to suicide that they support, suicide for particular groups. And as I'll explain and show later, that's problematic, because once you introduce a right and try and restrict it to a specific group, you're in trouble, and it will not stay restricted. But we can think a little bit more about that as well, because this principle of autonomy, which sounds important and indeed is important, it's an important aspect of society, our autonomy, but it's not an absolute. So we don't support an individual's right to buy and sell, for example, cocaine. We don't support committing incest, even with incest with consenting adults. We even remove your individual autonomy over the question of a seatbelt, for example. And what these things have in common is that they are autonomous decisions that would have a major influence and impact on society and on the people around us. And it is that impact that I think explains why we have these laws and restrictions on our autonomous behavior, and why the same should apply to assisted dying. And as the first select committee to look at this 30 years ago, concluded the interests of the individual cannot be separated from the interests in society. Dying is not only a personal or individual affair. So autonomy is not absolute, and this should be an area where that does not prevail. What about preventing indignity? Another very commonly invoked reason to support assisted dying. Well, it depends what you mean by indignity. All human beings, regardless of their abilities or lack of abilities, their health or illness, have a basic dignity, a human dignity, purely because they are humans and alive. And one illustration of that that's quite commonly used is an unconscious patient. Imagine a deeply unconscious patient who may or may not go on to survive, but is alive, but sustained in an intensive care unit with no responses, no suggestion that he can hear you, no suggestion that he or she can feel anything, deeply unconscious. Now, when the doctors, when the nurses, when the porters are in or around that patient, what they would not do is rest their coffee cup on the patient's chest. For example, he has a basic dignity, maybe has zero abilities at present, but you have a basic dignity. And that dignity is best protected not by putting terminally ill or severely disabled people in a separate category to able people, and a category which is suitable for dispatching, if you might say. What most people mean when they say protecting dignity, preventing indignity, is embarrassment from loss of bodily functions. And extraordinary though it may sound when laid out, incontinence of bowel function and bladder function rate extremely highly as reasons for dispatching people in those legislatures which have allowed assisted dying. This, I would suggest, is not how a civilized society should behave. And then the third principle is to prevent suffering, which again, at face value, sounds more than reasonable. But, first of all, is killing an individual, which is essentially what we're talking about, an appropriate response to suffering? Do we have an alternative? Yes, we have palliative care, and palliative care works. It's worth pointing out that in Belgium, which allows assisted dying, palliative care physician was invoked, was consulted in around about an eighth or a ninth of the cases of euthanasia. So palliative care works in the vast majority of cases, and allowing assisted dying for a small minority, making law around hard cases, is never wise. It's perhaps worth bearing in mind that the UK still tops the table in the provision of palliative care. We're not in a bad position in this country. But there's another aspect of suffering and preventing suffering, illustrated by that Times report and by that phrase, the doctors and pro-life opponents who prolonged his suffering. So there is, I mean, I would say a deliberate, but that's a purely subjective view. There is a confusion here that is commonly emphasized in the pro-assisted dying literature, which is that you have a choice between prolonging suffering and keeping a patient alive or assisted dying. It's not the case. So proper medical care, proper palliative care, does not involve and has never involved keeping a patient alive at all costs. That is not good medicine and never has been. It has no origin in medical ethics or law. What is important is the right not to be intentionally and purposefully killed. And in good medicine, it's perfectly licit and perfectly consistent with respecting the inviolability of life to withhold or withdraw treatment, even if it could be life-prolonging, if that treatment is futile, in other words, can't restore the patient to health, or if the treatment is burdensome, or indeed if the patient declines treatment. It is not necessary, from an ethical perspective, to use burdensome or futile patients, treatments that are aimed solely to keep the patient alive rather than to restore them to health. So preventing suffering doesn't hold water, again, as an argument. So what are the practical reasons to be cautious or to resist altogether this movement towards assisted dying? Well, probably the most commonly quoted one is the slippery slope. You allow it for a small group of terminally ill patients, and before long, the floodgates open, as it were, and the indications increase and increase and increase. And I would say there's two aspects to bear in mind with this. First of all, as I mentioned before, it is the case that it's not just likely that a slippery slope will occur. It is inevitable. Once you allow what is effectively a right for a small group of people, if you allow the principle that certain people are better off dead, then it becomes impossible to restrict that so-called benefit to people, say, who are incapable of asking to be killed because of their illness. So the question of consent gets eroded. It isn't possible or logical or rational to confine that benefit to one subsection of society. And it is the case that in every legislature, and there are now many, as you will know, in every legislature where assisted dying has been introduced, the slippery slope has been shown to be not just a potential risk, not just an inevitable risk, as I would argue, but has happened. We have the evidence now. And unless we argue that the UK is superior to all other societies in its parliamentary runnings, which I'd suggest we'd be on thin ice if we did, and that we could resist this even though everyone else has not, I think this is an overwhelming argument. So if we look at Netherlands, for example, physician-assisted suicide. So in peer-reviewed published articles looking at end-of-life practices, in the Netherlands, first of all, the law in the Netherlands allows physician-assisted suicide, but not euthanasia, active killing. You're allowed to help the patient to kill themselves, but not to administer the drugs yourself. But actually, euthanasia has been very common, become very common in the Netherlands and other and Belgium. Despite the fact that it's ostensibly against the law, there have never been any convictions. Looking at Belgium, and after 10 years or so of legalization in Belgium, around about a third of cases, there was no suggestion that the patient had actually requested this. So the question of consent has slipped simply is not present. Another way in which it has slipped, it's extended its indications, this again is from the Netherlands, from starting from terminal illness in adults, very quickly spreading to child euthanasia, and indeed infant euthanasia. These are small children, plainly unable to express a preference or consent, so this is unconsented, parental assent. And so kind of unashamed are the Dutch doctors of this, that they have described the protocol for euthanasia. And there are safeguards, and as you can see, there's the safeguard. After the decision's been made, after the child has died, an outside legal body determines whether the decision was justified. This is, I think, inevitable. This is what happens when you introduce these laws. Oregon is very commonly quoted as a state in the United States where this has been legalized 10 or 15 years ago now. And those in favor of assisted dying will say, well, this is a very good example where things have not slipped. But it's not the case, they have. It was introduced originally for terminal illness. Now individuals with non-terminal illness have been allowed. It was introduced originally just for individuals in Oregon. Now tourism, has been allowed, and individuals are coming elsewhere. And there have been various other ways in which the boundaries have slipped. So the slippery slope is real and inevitable. What are the other reasons to be cautious? The second one is what I've called unintended consequences. And I think first and foremost in these is the pressure that allowing assisted dying, legalizing this process, will put on the elderly and the vulnerable. All of a sudden, society has decided that it is perfectly acceptable and licit for individuals like you, a severely disabled individual, to be dispatched rather than cared for. So no wonder the elderly and vulnerable feel this pressure. And if you look, and this has been done many times, perhaps not surprisingly, who favors euthanasia? Well, only a third of the frail elderly, but nearly two-thirds of their relatives. It's most clearly opposed by the elderly, by the physically and mentally ill, by disability groups, I haven't included that on the slide, those in chronic pain. Most likely to support are white, male, wealthy, educated, and in good health. That alone, I think, should give us pause for thought. It also undermines the practice of medicine in two ways. It undermines palliative care. How can you persuade a government to invest heavily in palliative care when this this extraordinarily cheap alternative is available? But it undermines doctors more generally. As the GMC recognized, and I'll read it, it's blocked out, acting with the primary intention to hasten a patient's death would be difficult to reconcile with the medical ethical principle of beneficence and non-maleficence. More than that, it destroys the relationship. So as this is Dr. William Toffner, working in Oregon, since the voters of Oregon narrowly legalized physician-assisted suicide, there's been a profound shift towards medical care, a new fear and secrecy and a fixation on death. Groningen, again where it's been legalized, as I've mentioned, Theo Boer, who was in favor of assisted dying in limited circumstances originally, he has written, the very existence of a euthanasia law turns assisted suicide from a last resort into a normal procedure. So it has major effects. And to put it brutally, doctors can't inspire trust that is vital to deliver medical care, can't inspire that trust unless patients believe that the doctor is for no reason inclined to kill them, to dispatch them, have no inclination or legal requirement to ask the question of whether this is a patient whom we treat and would not suitable for assisted dying, or, thumbs down, this is a patient suitable for assisted dying. I don't think medicine could be practiced well in that circumstance. And then I think it's also just worth looking at some of the support and where it's coming from and why. And the first thing I would say is that many people who support assisted dying are doing so from perfectly, I would say misguided, but good intent to relieve suffering, to prevent indignity, to support autonomy. But there are other reasons as well. So Polly Toynbee, of course, will be known to you all, very prominent Guardian writer, in favour of assisted dying and has been on the board or possibly even chaired the Dignity in Dying Group, Voluntary Euthanasia Society, and she's written this. Another bad argument is that the frail will be intimidated, just as I've said, into hastening the end of their lives so as not to be a burden on their children. Well, why not? Why not hasten them? And in fact, if you look at Oregon, in the first year, 10% of patients adopting assisted dying listed being a burden as one of the motivations for seeking assisted suicide. 20 years later, over 50% of cases cite fear of being a burden as one of their reasons. Well, good riddance is effectively what Polly Toynbee is saying. Baroness Warnock, very eminent and very respected philosopher, Cambridge philosopher, she has said, again in favour of assisted dying, if you're demented, you're wasting people's lives, your family's lives, and you're wasting the resources of the NHS. And it's also true that economists have weighed in the argument. So this is Jacques Attali, ex-president of the European Bank for Reconstruction. He says, as soon as a man gets beyond 60 to 65, he lives beyond his capacity to produce, and he costs society a lot of money. Euthanasia will be one of the essential instruments for our future society. UK official report, the cost saving from a nationwide push towards living wills, not assisted dying, which would be even greater, is likely to be enormous. So I would argue that it is correct and ethical to terminate or withdraw treatments from a patient if the treatments are futile, can't restore health, and or burdensome. The palliative care works, but deliberately killing a patient or consciously and deliberately assisting a patient to commit suicide cannot be justified and would have huge adverse consequences. As I've said, many of those supporting it don't have the same motivation as our economists or some of our Guardian writers, but one of the great mistakes, as Milton Friedman said, one of the great mistakes is to judge policies and programs, and especially laws, you might add, by their intentions rather than their results. So that's a take on assisted dying, one end of topping and tailing. What about the other end? And that relates much more to the science of multiple sclerosis. And of course, the ideal approach to simply remove the question of assisted dying would be to prevent disability from occurring in the first place, or to reverse disability once it has occurred. So are there ways of doing that? And that has very much been the focus of my research, of the group at French Cheyenne, now Southmead, over the last couple of decades. So here is some science, and this is, in a nutshell, the science of multiple sclerosis. Multiple sclerosis is a very unusual illness in that it's essentially an illness not of all the different types of cell in the nervous system, but of one specific cell type, And that's illustrated here. This is a cell called the oligodendrocyte, and the oligodendrocyte is a complicated cell situated throughout the brain and the spinal cord, and which has pretty much only a single function. And that function is to elaborate this membranous layer that, as you can see on the far left, that's wrapped around nerve fibers or nerve cables. And that's called myelin. So oligodendrocytes make myelin, and the myelin is wrapped around axons, nerve fibers, nerve cables, in the central nervous system, in the brain and the spinal cord. And the function of that myelin is essentially to act as insulation. So nerve fibers, axons, work by sending electrical impulses along their length from the brain, for example, down to a muscle. And that conduction of that electrical impulse absolutely depends on this myelin made by oligodendrocytes. And in multiple sclerosis, for some reason that we do not fully understand, oligodendrocytes in patches around the nervous system are attacked by the immune system and killed, and the myelin is lost. And there, the kind of illustration of insulation, myelin being an insulation, breaks down, because if you remove insulation from an electric cable, that electric cable will still conduct. If you remove the myelin sheath by killing the oligodendrocyte, if you remove the myelin sheath, the nerve fiber won't conduct effectively. And so whatever it was supposed to do, make a particular muscle contract, for example, or take messages from the eye to the brain as part of your vision, can no longer occur. And so you develop a neurological problem depending on where in the nervous system those oligodendrocytes have been killed. Now, in most neurological diseases, lots of different cell types are affected, and you get damage to lots of different types of cell in the brain or the spinal cord. In multiple sclerosis, principally, it's just oligodendrocytes. And that is important because it has given rise to the idea that maybe if you just replace these oligodendrocytes using exogenous tissue of some sort, you could make new myelin sheaths from these added oligodendrocytes and repair the damage. And of course, we can see exactly where those scars are, where those areas without myelin are, from an MRI scan, as I mentioned at the beginning. So the idea, which is truly not rocket science, is to see where those areas are from an MRI scan, to inject those areas directly, neurosurgically, with a source of oligodendrocytes. And many, many rodent experiments in the 1960s and 70s and early 80s, not least from an individual called Bill Blakemore in Cambridge, who probably should have got a Nobel Prize for this work, showed that this principle in animal models would work very well. You damage an area of myelin and later inject cells that can make oligodendrocytes, then those oligodendrocytes would make new myelin and repair that tissue. So from animal models, rodent studies, it looked viable. The difficulty with humans is, of course, a source of oligodendrocytes. Where would you get them? And then in the 1990s, the science of stem cells emerged, and very quickly it became clear that stem cells could represent a source of oligodendrocytes and solve this problem, essentially, of where you would get cells from for this complicated technique. So what's a stem cell? This is a group of them growing in the laboratory, a whole bunch of them clumped together. And a stem cell is a cell with two key properties. First of all, it can divide and make more of itself and do that more or less endlessly. So you can end up with millions, billions, trillions of cells just from one cell. And secondly, it can turn into, it is the stem of everything that makes up an adult individual. It can turn into, these stem cells can turn into specialized skin cells, they can turn into specialized heart cells, to muscle, and they can turn into all the different sorts of brain cell. So ostensibly, even one single stem cell could be a source of endless numbers of oligodendrocytes to inject into patients to cure, effectively, the damage from multiple sclerosis. So you can begin to see why there was so much enormous excitement about stem cells, not just amongst those of us interested in multiple sclerosis, but the same applied to all sorts of heart diseases. You could replace heart tissue, kidney diseases, and so on. You could turn these cells into anything that you want. So where's the downside? And the downside is where you might get these cells. Because the obvious place, and the place where they were first identified, originally in rodent studies, the obvious place where massive growth is occurring, and when all the different sorts of tissue that make us up are being developed from one or two cells, is the embryo. And the difficulty is, of course, that if we want human cells, human stem cells, then we would need a human embryo, and you can only get stem cells from the embryo by destroying the embryo. So the ethics of that, to my mind, the science might be a little bit complicated. The ethics are extremely straightforward. The human embryo, at whatever stage you're thinking of it, is alive. If it wasn't alive, it wouldn't be useful as a source of stem cells. It is human behind the box, or again, it wouldn't be useful. It is an individual. At the stage we're talking about, it could not divide. It's not many individuals. It's a single living human individual. It is part of...
Mm. As to why it kills the embryo, why can't you just take off one cell?
People have tried. Some have claimed success, but whenever it's been tried more rigorously, then you end up killing probably two-thirds or maybe three-quarters of the embryos that you try and get them from. So it's not necessarily fatal, but is largely fatal to the embryo. So it's a human being, and destroying a human being, this is the other end of topping and tailing, is not a path that we ought to go. So that is how things stood, I would say, around about 2000. A group, the great majority, I would say, of scientists saying this is a path that we should take. We've already had the argument about abortion. It's legal, which is, of course, absolutely true in most Western societies. Since it's legal, we should go forward with this. But it hasn't gone forward to any great extent. You will not be aware of any embryonic stem cell therapy, despite the fact that the first signs of this first began to emerge well over now, 20 years ago. And I would say there are two reasons for this, not entirely to do, although as you'll see, not unrelated, not entirely to do with the ethics, but two completely divergent paths, one of which we've adopted and one we haven't, that have led effectively to the end of embryonic stem cell research. And the first is that a group of individuals, but principally Yamanaka in Tokyo, developed an alternative way of getting stem cells. So rather than taking them from an embryo, what he and others discovered was that you can take any cell from any adult, however old, 60s, 70s, 80 years old, a blood cell, which you can get very easily, of course, a cell from the lining of the mouth, the inside of the cheek, which you can just scrape off with a wooden spatula and get very easily, and you can reprogram those cells. You can expose them initially to four, but subsequently it's been refined to three or more specific factors, which effectively turn that cell, highly specialized blood cell, for example, back, evolutionarily backwards, and make it start behaving like an embryonic stem cell. So this is called cellular reprogramming. These are called inducible pluripotent stem cells for what that matters, but they are essentially synthetic stem cells. Now, the huge advantage of this, from an ethical perspective, of course, they don't involve embryos at all. You can get them from an adult. But the real advantage medically is that you would get them from the patient themselves. Patient with multiple sclerosis, you scrape their inside of their cheek, you get these cells, you expose them to these chemicals, you make these stem cells, you turn the stem cells into oligodendrocytes and inject them back into the patient. And the beauty of that is that because those cells originally came from the cheek of the patient, then they're not foreign cells. The patient wouldn't recognize them as foreign cells and mount immune response, which would be the case if you'd used embryonic stem cells. So this was a huge deal in science. Yamanaka did get a Nobel Prize. It was the science advance of the year. It's become a huge industry. It still hasn't actually produced any treatments, I might say, but it has more or less completely displaced working with embryonic tissue, which is awkward and difficult. And the reason I said this development is not entirely unrelated to the ethics is that when subsequently people like Shinya Yamanaka, who's become a kind of international science celebrity, reflects on this, he says, when I saw the embryo, because originally he had worked on conventional embryonic stem cells, I suddenly realized, and I'll read it again because it's slightly blocked, there was such a small difference between it and my daughter's. I thought, we can't keep destroying embryos for our research. There must be another way. And he went ahead, unlike the rest of us, and developed another way. So inducible pluripotent stem cells, synthetic embryonic stem cells, you might call them. So that's one way in which the science moved forward. But there was another. And I've stuck there a huge question mark over the embryo, but I think it could also stick a question mark, and this has been my problem, as it were, and many scientists' problem with this approach, with synthetic embryonic stem cells as well. Because however you get your embryonic stem cell, it has always seemed to me that this is a deeply unconvincing principle to develop a treatment. To take a cell that is either embryonic or you have made into effectively an embryonic cell, whose normal function is to make lots of different tissues and form an individual, a separate organism, that is its biological function. But to take that cell and to plant it into tissue, which is maybe 50 years old, instead of surrounded its normal surrounding of other embryonic cells, not only is that tissue 50 years old or whatever, certainly adult, but it is also highly diseased. And to expect that embryonic stem cell, which normally would make an embryo and then a fetus, to expect that cell to sense the damage that's going on, to respond to it, and to replace the cell that is missing, seems deeply unconvincing to me. And I think that is the reason why not only have we no embryonic stem cell therapies, but we've no successful inducible pluripotent stem cell, synthetic stem cell therapies either. So we haven't started working with these synthetic stem cells, even though ethically they are robust. I would say that scientifically it's not a rational approach, not for this sort of disease, and we could discuss that later. There are things that they might be able to do. What we've done instead is to look at a completely different sort of stem cell, and this is the stem cell that's present in bone marrow. There is a form of stem cell present in bone marrow, and that's present in infant and juvenile and indeed embryonic bone marrow, but it's also present in adult bone marrow. And it's important to say at the outset that this is a modified, and if you like, limited stem cell. This is not a stem cell that could make an individual. They don't have that propensity. But they are present in all of us, so we have, in fact, two different sorts of stem cell in our bone marrow. We have the cells that are capable of making our blood and all its components, red cells, white cells, platelets, and so on. But those, what are called hematopoietic stem cells, are supported by another type of stem cell called a mesenchymal stem cell, or MSC, it doesn't really matter. But that supporting function, which is what we thought its sole function of these cells was, to help other cells turn into blood, turns out not to be the case. Because these cells that are present throughout life in our bone marrow have as their function helping to repair tissue and combat disease. So this is a New England Journal review from a long time back now, looking at these cells and describing how what happens when you have illness, say a diseased liver, principally illustrated, or a diseased skin, as you can see in the top right-hand corner, or I would say, and indeed the article writes about, a diseased nervous system, the area of disease, the area of damage, releases signals that go into the bloodstream, that go back to the bone marrow, and trigger the release of these bone marrow cells into the bloodstream. So an ill patient will have far more of these cells in their bloodstream than a healthy patient, whatever their illness. And then the second type of factor made by the diseased tissue stays in the tissue and attracts the cells from the bloodstream. And of course, every single organ that we've got has a blood supply to keep it alive, attracts the cells out of the blood vessels, where you can see them, and into the area of damage. Two types of signal, one to increase the number of cells released from the bone marrow, one to pull these cells into the area of damage. And once they get into the area of damage, they promote repair, and they have many different properties. Just the same as ordinary white blood cells have many properties that can fight infection, even a single cell type, 100 different functions. So these cells have many functions to promote repair and combat disease. They can promote more blood coming in to bring more oxygen. They release growth factors to stimulate cells locally. They reduce scar formation. They protect against different damage. They modulate the immune system. So these are the body's own repair cells. And you might say, well, why do we get diseases? But of course, they are limited in their function. They get overwhelmed. And so the whole concept of disease becomes slightly altered in its definition as a situation where your own repair mechanism is overwhelmed. And we and many groups reasoned that if this is their normal function, then firstly, to try and use them to promote repair is intrinsically more attractive logically, because you're simply trying to get cells to do more of what they are designed, as it were, have evolved to do. And secondly, if we can get them from the bone marrow and then re-inject them into the bloodstream, then we should be able to have what you might call pharmacological quantities of these cells in the blood rather than the normal physiological quantities. If you have more cells in the blood, then you should get more in the area of damage. And if you have more cells in the area of damage, then their ability to promote repair and resist damage should be enhanced. So we have a very simple approach of taking these cells from the bone marrow, either expanding them or selecting them, and different people have different approaches, and then simply re-injecting them into the bloodstream, knowing that in multiple sclerosis, the areas of tissue damage are releasing these signals. So if there are more of these cells in the bloodstream, more will get into the areas of damage, and you will get more repair. And we have shown in a lot of different studies over the years, in different animal models, and in a lot of human work as well, that each of these principles does indeed obtain. If you inject the cells, there are more in the bloodstream. If you look later on, there are far more of them in areas of damage in the brain. And if you look later on still, you will get much more repair. And on that background, we launched a small pilot study quite a long time ago now, 10 years ago, trying to show that this principle was safe, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be, and potentially effective. And we showed that it was indeed safe and feasible in a phase one study, and we subsequently launched a phase two trial looking at 80 patients and treating them in a controlled way to see whether this does actually help to reduce damage and promote repair in patients with long-standing multiple sclerosis. And I should mention that many groups around the world are now pursuing exactly the same approach, not just for multiple sclerosis, but in other diseases as well, in stroke and Parkinson's disease and motor neuron disease as well. Whether or not they will work, we don't know yet. The translated. So that trial that I mentioned has literally just been completed by Claire Rice, who's taken over the group since I mostly retired, and we will have those results once she has finished analysing them over the next 12 months. What this illustrated, as Pope John Paul said, is that the Church is not anti-science, which is such a common misperception, and perhaps part of the reason for the Christians in Science group to fight that common misconception. Even, I might say, as a Catholic, even the Catholic Church is not anti-science and sees science as a service to truth and goodness and beauty. And I will stop there. Thank you again for the invitation, and I'm happy to take any questions.
So, thanks very much, Neil. That was fascinating. I imagine there are quite a few questions. So if you'd like to put your hand up, and then Tina will bring you the microphone, and you can ask it so everybody can hear.
Beaten into submission.
John's over there.
You gave a wonderful case for palliative care.
Thank you.
But how widely available is it?
Not perfectly available. Not perfectly available.
I mean, the huge number of huge needs.
So huge need, and of course,
not a solution if you got
and a growing need, and it needs investment. But I would say that shortage of any particular subspecialty of medicine shouldn't be a reason for dispatching that group of patients. You're allowed.
Oh, have we got one there first? Hey, ask yours first.
Thank you for your talk.
Thank you.
So with the embryonic stem cell rights, I know that was quite difficult, and people started coming up with other methods with, like,
yes,
bone marrow and the synthetic ones.
Yes.
But didn't they also find that you could use stem cells from the umbilical cord, which could differentiate into more types of specialised cells than bone marrow?
Yes, and I should have mentioned that, and they can indeed turn into more specialised types. I would say that, and there was a huge interest in umbilical cord cells for a while, I would say that it's been slightly eclipsed, if you like, by the synthetic stem cells, but I think eclipsed wrongly, and there is still ongoing research, and I think there is great potential there, and a more comprehensive talk would have covered that. Yeah, no, it's a very good point. And there are others. There are others as well. There are other potential sources as well that I've not had time to mention.
I just wondered if you wanted to say anything about Made in Canada, because I've been very shocked, and the whole relationship with what Trudeau's doing.
Canada has been
a
perfect example again of it's such a tedious term, the slippery slope term, but it's been a huge example. Introduced medical assistance in Nyang Maid, introduced initially just for terminally ill patients whose death was predicted within 6 months, and spreading massively, and now introduced for depression, for psychological and psychiatric illnesses, extending to children, put as an option to individuals with significant inflammatory illnesses like rheumatoid arthritis who say they cannot afford treatment. Well, what about assisted dying then? Have you considered that? Another aspect of Canada that I haven't gone into at all, and again, there isn't really time to go into it, is the degree of, I'm not sure coercion is the right word. Doctors are losing their licenses if they refuse to, and nurses are losing their jobs if they refuse to be part of this. So in the UK, as you will know, where, as I've mentioned, abortion is legal, midwives, nurses, doctors who are ethically opposed are perfectly allowed to work in other areas and not get involved in that practice. So conscientious objection in medicine, is a very established right, not just in the UK, but across the world. And that has been completely, that's completely disappeared in Canada. You're not allowed to conscientiously object and work as a doctor for the state.
sorry. Going back to MS and the oligodendrocytes, why do they die in the first place?
Yes.
And is that, although your stem cells may replace them or help to grow again, is that process that killed them in the, or made them die in the first place not going to continue?
Yeah, very, very good question. The short answer to the second part is that we don't know, because this hasn't properly been established as a treatment yet. In theory, it could happen, but what I would say is that in patients with multiple sclerosis, the average interval from first contracting the disease, or actually that indeed is not true, from first being known to have the disease, which probably has been going on for 2 or 3 years already, first being diagnosed to having major disability is normally 25 to 30 years. In those individuals who do develop disability, and it is not all, and as I've said, that's an interesting aspect. So essentially, if after 30 years you treat them with these cells and it works, then at the very least you would expect that you've got another 30 years use, if you like, out of these cells. But of course, to go back to your first question, it would be far better. We wouldn't need any of this if we were able to prevent the damage in the first place. And there are better and better treatments that appear to be able to do that, at least preventing the initial inflammation that leads to that damage. One of the very curious and disappointing things is that a lot of those treatments, while preventing the inflammation that we thought was responsible for the whole thing, and certainly helping to prevent those areas of damage that you can see, have been very poor at preventing long-term disability, suggesting there's other stuff going on that we're not fully aware of.
When you say inflammation, are we talking autoimmune?
Yes.
So are there any antibody treatments available? Are they showing any success?
Yes. Exactly so. Starting probably about 15 years ago, the first monoclonal antibodies, which are antibodies that are effectively designed in the laboratory to target one very, very specific molecule, and you can choose whichever molecule you like. So they were originally the first specific treatment for many diseases. And as I said, starting 15 years ago, the first monoclonal antibodies in MS. Now there are 8 or 9 licensed, funded in the UK, monoclonal antibodies, nearly all of which are extremely good at preventing the appearance of those patches of inflammation. Whether that translates into stopping long-term disability actually seems to be unexpectedly seems to be a different question, because some of them may, some of them certainly don't prevent long-term disability. So those visible patches that I showed you from the first post-mortem studies 200 years ago to the MRI scan are not, sadly, the be-all and end-all of multiple sclerosis. There's other things going on that are harder to see, but nonetheless functionally important.
But would it not be worth combining?
Very much so, yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I've got a question. So I have a friend who was diagnosed with MS quite young, and then, so how many years, sorry, first of all, is it inevitable that if you have been diagnosed with MS that you will develop it? And what proportion escape you're having it?
Yes. Very, very good question. It is absolutely not inevitable. Those who do, it will take 20 or 30 years, but a significant proportion, over 50%, don't have any major disability after 15 years, after even 20 years. about somewhere between 10 and 20% never develop major disability. Now, at the beginning of their illness, when they first come because they've lost function in a hand or lost vision in an eye, do an MRI scan, it shows these patches of inflammation, do other tests, lumbar puncture tests. At the beginning of the illness, they would look absolutely identical to those who go on and develop major disability. So there is something about what's going on in their brain, in their spinal cord, or maybe something that's going on in their immune system that we have no idea about. It's acquired the label benign MS, and it's almost a different disease, except that even under the microscope in individuals who've there's some very fascinating, if slightly morbid, work looking at individuals who've only just been diagnosed and kind of, it's not funny, but kind of went out from the clinic and got knocked over by a bus, so have died very quickly from multiple sclerosis, and the tissue looks exactly the same. Inflammation, killing oligodendrocytes in patches around the nervous system. And yet we know that some go on to develop major disability, some don't.
Sorry, I couldn't understand the argument as to why cells, for example, from the cheek are inappropriate for the
surgeon treatment. Because what you're doing, why they, I would say, are logically inappropriate, is that you are turning the clock back in these cells, effectively. It's a lay term, but it's really a very accurate term, so that they are no longer cells from my 65-year-old cheek. They are behaving exactly as though they are a 15-day embryo. Exactly. You couldn't distinguish the two from a truly 15-day-old cell. And so to take a cell that is effectively a 15-day-old cell, and to place it into an adult diseased environment, into the brain of somebody who's had a stroke or somebody who's got multiple sclerosis or whatever, and to anticipate that that cell whose normal function is to go on and make kidney or heart or lung or everything, including brain, to assume that it will know, as it were, that it's supposed to be making oligodendrocytes to cure this MS, has no rational basis. There's no reason why it should be able to do that. Whereas a bone marrow cell whose primary function is to respond to damage and repair it is intrinsically more likely to be able to do that successfully.
Thank you for your talk. I agree in broad principle with what you're saying about topping and tailing, but I can also perhaps see exceptions at both ends. I'll give a couple of examples, and I'm sure there are many more. I mean, if I was a woman who'd been raped and then conceived, and then I didn't want to give birth to the offspring of the offender who'd, done the deed, I can see a case there. It's an unfortunate one, but then these things come out of unfortunate circumstances. At the other end, as I'm getting old and creaky, I can see there might come a point where I think, I'm in too much pain. I don't want to continue. I wouldn't want anyone else involved in it, but I wouldn't see it as a right to end my life. But I think that choice is sort of inescapably there. So I think there are questions about that. And there's one more question. I certainly question the right or wisdom or whatever you want to call it to carry out experiments on animals, albeit for the advantage or alleged advantage of human beings. So I don't know, perhaps you can give a reflection on
yes,
that.
Yes, very happy to.
But the other thing, this whole language of rights concerns me because it poses the question, where or who confers this right?
Couldn't agree more. Yes.
Yeah, and I think there are loads of big question marks around all that.
Yeah.
Do you? Thank you.
Yeah. So to work through those, rape is, of course, well, A, horrible, and B, a very hard case. The principle that if you like, the other human being involved has had no part in this rape and is a human being and not therefore dispensable, still holds. So that's the principle why there is a difficulty with abortion for rape. We're not primarily talking about abortion in the things that I'm discussing. But I think that principle, whilst a very hard one, is still there. Pragmatically, would most anti-abortionists be happier if abortion was illegal for all individuals except rape? Well, that would be, 99.9% of abortions. You're talking a tiny number. As I mentioned before, hard cases, as lawyers would always say, make bad law, and the same applies with euthanasia. There are individuals in whom palliative care is less successful. My response to that would be that we need to do better and do more research and to build palliative care. And this is a point I was trying to make and was insufficiently articulate. Even if you accept the principle that in some individuals it doesn't seem a wrong act, to change the whole law for that number of individuals has such terrible consequences for the rest of society, for the practice of medicine, for other vulnerable individuals, that it is a dangerous path to take. And then the third point concerning animal research, it's a very difficult question. At various points, I have my own group been invited to be involved in non-human primate research and have always rejected that as a possibility. I've taken an extraordinarily unsophisticated line that if we're prepared to eat an animal then and to kill it to feed people, then we should also be prepared to kill animals for medical benefits. But even that has limits. Making an animal suffer and suffer in a prolonged way is not the same as killing it to eat it. I've not been involved in research that involves inducing long-term diseases, if you like. The restrictions on rodent research, and it's only ever rodents that I've worked with, are tighter and tighter concerning the welfare of the animals, so that they are better cared for than most farm animals. But I think it's a really difficult question. Were I a vegetarian, I think, and one understands the principles of that, I think I would very much argue that we shouldn't be using animals for research either.
I enjoyed your talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can early onset MS be genetic, inherited?
Yes, it's a very curious thing. So, and the subject of huge amounts of research. So if you take identical twins, and there have been many, many studies looking at identical twins with MS, if one twin develops MS, the chances of the other twin developing it are just over 30%. Whereas the background risk in society is 1 in 1,000. So a huge increase in when you have genetic identity. And a brother or sister, the risk is about 2%. So still much, much higher than the background population. But the really interesting thing is that in an identical twin, the risk is that 30%. It's not 100%. So there's a major genetic influence, but not an absolute influence. Two-thirds of people with an identical genome, actually it's not entirely identical, as any geneticist would in the audience might quickly tell me, it's, to all intents and purposes, the closest to an identical. They still won't get it. Two-thirds of them won't get it. So there are a mixture of genetic factors and environmental factors, and a huge amount of research into both. The genetic factors are more and more complicated, and it very much seems to be tiny, tiny, tiny contributions, raising your risk by 0.5% or less of 50 or 60 different genes, mostly to do with immune function, which in a sense has been a really interesting scientific endeavor to establish what those genes are, but disappointing hugely from a medical perspective, because this, there are 50 or 60, and each one has only a tiny influence, but cumulatively they build up to that 30%. It makes it really hard to design treatments that might ameliorate that risk. And the environmental factors, people have looked for different viruses. Epstein-Barr, glandular fever virus, has been implicated and then excluded and then implicated again, and it's just over the years it's come and gone, and other viruses as well. It may play a role. The other thing that seems to play a huge role is the sun. So the incidence, and I could go on for hours, but I'll stop at some point. The prevalence of multiple sclerosis increases the further you get away from the equator in either direction. So on the equator, and Uganda, for example, is on the equator, literally straddles the equator, there is no MS at all. None, absolutely none. I've not seen a case all the years I've been going. Neither have many other neurologists. Come up to the UK, and there's quite a high incidence, even within the UK, much higher incidence in the north of Scotland than in the south of England. It's a very clear and repeatedly found observation and completely defied explanation for many, many years, up until about 5 years ago, when suddenly thought, well, what about sun and sunlight? When it was realized that sunlight has a huge impact on our vitamin D levels, and vitamin D is not just about healthy bones and teeth, although it is, it has a huge influence on the immune system. So vitamin D and your vitamin D levels and exposure to sunlight are one of the major environmental factors.
Hello. Coming back to the ethics side of things, I'm sympathetic with every one of those 6 points you bring out. Can I ask you, are you able to say what is your underlying fundamental objection? Have you got one that is giving you the passion against?
Yes, and what I have singly failed to do, there was a major part that I, that when I was first making notes for this, that was the first thing I wrote down, completely in various iterations lost, and I'm really sorry for that. What I haven't done, what I haven't said, is that a major reason for objecting to assisted dying and euthanasia, but also to destroying embryos for the sake of getting stem cells, is that our lives are not our own, and as far as we can tell, and we have the commandments, deliberately killing an innocent individual is prescribed, is not something we should be doing. Deliberately killing an innocent individual, thou shalt not kill, is quite an important part of Christianity. I have never mentioned that in any of the more public debates that I've been in, and there have been a few. The moment you invoke religion, you have lost the argument. You have absolutely lost the argument. And indeed, in the stem cell debates, I was asked to speak at a what was supposed to be in a scientific meeting in Parliament, and that was chaired by Jenny Tong, who was a Liberal Democrat peer at that stage and chairman of the party at that Liberal Democrat party at that stage. And as I was walking up to be the first speaker to argue against using embryonic stem cells, She said that what she wanted to do was for all the speakers, somebody had warned her, all the speakers to declare their religious affiliation before they spoke. And that was one of the first talks that I'd actually given in Parliament, and I was already slightly overwhelmed, and I had no proper response to this. But of course one should have refused and invoked all sorts of logic about listening to somebody regardless of their colour, creed or race, and inviting individuals to listen to what I was saying rather than my background. But anyway, I still haven't actually answered your question, which is that I think it's wrong for, not necessarily, thin ice here, not necessarily because the Bible says so, because it seems to me logical that it is wrong to kill an individual, an innocent individual, even if they are asking to be killed. And all of medicine, of course, spends a lot of time trying to prevent suicides, and society as well, with the Samaritans. How we could square that with this defies, I didn't get it.
I thought that's where you would be coming from. And how can I put this? I just want to put a slightly different view. I used to hold that view for the same reasons as you do. And I used to be a nurse, and when I was a charged nurse, I refused to give morphine where I knew it was going above the pain relief, and it was actually prescribed to speed the...
With the intention of killing.
Yes. Yeah. So I refused, and I still would. However, and this year, my mother, who was dying, said to me, can't you give me something to stop this? And I said, no, because if I did, they'd take me to put me in prison. But that was because I knew she wasn't really suffering, and it was... If I actually said, here, this will stop you, you'll be dead in 5 minutes, she wouldn't do it. But what I am in a position now is I don't have a moral problem with helping someone to die per se. But lots of those reasons you've given, I wouldn't want to be the person that allowed it to happen as a law, primarily because of the slippery slope. Evidenced by Canada and Belgium. Yeah.
It's a difficult area.
But you probably, from a moral point of view, would say no, 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 no. And I would say I would do it. I don't know if I would enact a law to do it, though.
Can we have one last question here, John?
There's a couple of interesting programmes on radio. There have been on Radio 4 recently. One was The Moral Maze.
Yeah, I missed that.
What was interesting was that there was a humanist that was opposing it, and then there was a rabbi supporting it. And there was also The Briefing Room, which is also... They're on BBC Sounds. You can listen again. I think they're very interesting. Yeah. It shows both sides of the argument.
The Moral Maze is often very good, isn't it?
It's quite sort of polarised.
Yes, and quite rowdy.
It's well worth listening to.
We've grilled you for long enough. I think we ought to go there. But thanks very much. Touching on these difficult ethical issues, you feel very exposed actually, and I know what you must have felt like on that committee. And it's like being asked about animal research. It's a very delicate one. So thank you very much. I'd love if we had more time to ask you about your work in Uganda and Nodding's disease and things, but we haven't got time. But for those, I hope you could stay around 15 minutes or so. And anybody got any personal questions? But if we could now give Neil a good thank you. Thank you.